A Dreamer Deported, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. It's a program that's meant to protect the children of immigrants from deportation. But under President Trump, many so-called dreamers are afraid it won't.
When I drive, I'm extra careful. I can't help but look over my shoulder. That is the new normal.
Plus, Trump says Korea used to be part of China. Seoul says no way. So who's right? And detectives investigate an unusual robbery in London.
They had a couple of giraffes. Both the lions that you can see here were taken. Two of the zebras. Yeah, they took the chimpanzee in the top hat, which actually does quite well as a prop.
It's the Great British Taxidermy Heist. Seriously, it's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Thanks for joining us. Let's start today by talking about dreamers. Those are the immigrants who came to the U.S. as children without documentation and received DACA status. DACA is short for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It was initiated by President Obama in 2012, but Obama's not in the White House anymore. And despite President Trump's contention that he has a big heart when it comes to dreamers, many with DACA status are increasingly worried, particularly since 23-year-old Juan Manuel Montes, who thought he had DACA protection, was deported to his native Mexico in February. Martha Zavala Perez also has DACA status. She was born in Mexico and found out she was undocumented when she applied to community college. Martha, the attorneys for Juan Manuel Montes says their client was funneled across the border without so much as a piece of paper to explain why. What did you think when you heard the news about him?
The immigrant community, we know how Border Patrol works, and they funnel people through. They ignore due process. To be honest, when I found out that Juan Manuel Montes had been deported, I was not surprised. I knew it was going to happen. It was just a matter of time.
Many media reports suggest Montes is the first deported dreamer, and he's not. I mean, as you probably know, many people with DACA were actually deported under Obama. Montes is the first deported under Trump. For you, does that make this case different? And if so, how?
Yes, it definitely makes it different because, of course, we don't find this administration credible. Right. If on the one hand you tell me, follow the rules, do what you need to do, and I'm not going to hurt you. But then this happens. Right. So, again, actions versus words. Even with DACA, we are not safe under this administration.
Are you or other DACA recipients that you know altering how you're living day to day, given the uncertainties you face now?
Oh, 100%. Every single day when I leave my home, I pray to God I'm going to come back home to see my mother. Right? Every single day I go to work, I have no idea what's going to happen, what I'm going to face. When I drive, I'm extra careful. I can't help but look over my shoulder. That is the new normal, to constantly be aware. I'm constantly checking my wallet to make sure I have my DACA permit with me, because nothing makes me feel safe at this point.
It's hard to get a grip on just what the White House policy is toward dreamers. Here's President Trump when he was asked by a reporter in January whether he would continue the DACA program.
The DACA situation is it's a very difficult thing for me because, you know, I love these kids. I love kids. I have kids and grandkids. And I find it very, very hard doing what the law says exactly to do. And, you know, the law is rough. I'm not talking about new laws. I'm talking the existing law. Is very rough. It's very, very rough.
Martha, what did you hear in that statement?
I heard a bunch of words, but no actual sentiments, no actual promises, no actual policy. And the current law states that a DACA individual has the right to due process and cannot be deported. In the case of Juan Manuel Montes, why were his attorneys not notified? Why did he not have his day in court?
Martha, tell us a bit about your own story. How did you end up in the U.S.?
I was born in Mexicali, Mexico. And when I was about a year old, my parents chose to come to this country. By no means was it an easy choice. It was one of looking for greater opportunity, looking for jobs, looking for education. And I was brought to this country, but because my parents knew that racism was alive and well in the United States, they chose to raise me with the belief that I was an American citizen. And so growing up, I never doubted myself. I never doubted my worth, my value, or my right to be in this country. It wasn't until I was 17 and I was applying to college that my parents said, no, you can't send in those applications because you weren't born in this country. So at 17, I had to come to grips with my new identity. I had to meet with lawyers, figure out what I was and was not allowed to do. And I had to understand the fact that there are people in this country who do not believe in my right to be here.
Martha Zavala Perez was born in Mexico. She has DACA status and teaches at California State University, Channel Islands. Thanks, Martha.
Thank you, Carol.
Do deportations really fix the problem of illegal immigration? The World's Maria Muriel has been digging into this, and you can check out her reporting at PRI.org. Let's stick with the theme of immigration. It appears there's been a drop in illegal border crossings at the U.S.-Mexico border compared to previous years. It could be a Trump effect or just part of an ongoing decline. One thing we do know, in recent years, most people crossing from Mexico into the U.S. have not been Mexicans. They're Central Americans, Haitians, and others. And these days, some of them are choosing to stay in Mexico. Amy Bracken has more from the Mexico-Guatemala border.
It's a bright Sunday morning, and the Suchiate River bustles with makeshift rafts loaded with people. It's a popular place to cross between Guatemala and Mexico. It's known as Paso del Coyote, or Coyote Pass. Crossing is easy. There's no wall, no border patrol in sight. Luis Fernando Perez operates a raft here and for years has brought across passengers and migrants from Central America. But lately he's seen a change. He says since Donald Trump took office, he's seen a dramatic drop in people passing through. They fear getting caught at the U.S. border, he says. Mexico is also reporting fewer Central American migrants. And while it's too early to link the shift to Trump, you will spot one change here. For those migrants still crossing, still fleeing parts of Central America and its violence, some of them are now deciding to stay here in Mexico.
Correcto, gracias. Hablamos más tarde.
Ramon Verduga runs a migrant shelter not far from the river in the city of Tapachula.
Había mucha ansiedad. Había mucha ansiedad, mucha angustia.
He says there was a lot of anxiety in the shelter when Trump won. People felt rushed to get to the U.S. before he was sworn in. Now, because of what Verduga calls the closing of the U.S. border, some migrants are resigning themselves to staying in Mexico and applying for asylum here. You can see what Verduga is talking about throughout Tapachula. Patricia Portillo and her three daughters are at a hotel here. The family fled gang extortion and a kidnapping threat in El Salvador. Portillo says Trump has changed her plans. She'll seek asylum here because they're not giving asylum in the U.S., she says. She has heard that's Trump's policy. And while that's not true, asylum in the U.S. is still granted to some Central Americans. It's tough and set to get tougher. It's enough to convince the mom to stay put in Mexico, far from the threats she faces in El Salvador. It's like an invisible wall has been erected within Mexico, with people from Central Americans to Haitians and Cubans having left their homes but now feeling unwilling to head to the U.S. Jean Duberval Aristide is among the Haitians here who migrated to Brazil until work dried up there, so he headed north. But as word spread that the U.S. might not welcome him, Aristide reconsidered his plans. He says he's no longer planning to go to the U.S. He doesn't want to put himself through that humiliation. Instead, he wants to get Mexican papers and live here. He says the Obama administration made him question going to the U.S., but Trump clinched his decision to stay in Mexico. Meanwhile, some migrants here are looking for a way to get through Mexico and the U.S. After I speak with Aristide, one of his friends asks me a question that I've heard before and to which I have no answer. He wants to know if there's a way for migrants to get directly from here to Canada. For the World, Amy Bracken, Tapachula, Mexico.
Hi, Gina. It's Carol in Boston.
Hi, Carol. How are you?
Gina Moore is the global women's rights correspondent for BuzzFeed. I know, a pretty distinctive title. We reached Moore just before she boarded a flight. Her latest piece is about French presidential hopeful Marine Le Pen, who's been showing a more feminine side in order to attract women voters. Marine Le Pen is the head of a far-right anti-immigration party in France called the National Front. Moore says the softening of Marine Le Pen's image started with a TV appearance.
It's almost somewhere between Oprah and Barbara Walters.
Alors quand vous étiez petite, vous étiez très garçon manqué. On vous appelait Miss Trompe-la-Mort. J'ai eu des fractures, des entorses, trois traumatismes crâniens.
Oui, c'est tout. Non, mais je faisais tout n'importe quoi.
It was designed to look and feel a lot like a garden party at the very beginning. The host and Marine Le Pen are outside. It's sunny. There's flowers everywhere. They're talking about how much they love gardening. There's a nice French wine on the table. There's nice French pastries on the table. And all these charming photographs of a beautiful little Marine Le Pen when she was a kid.
Et vos parents, vous disaient quoi?
Ils étaient un peu lassés, hein.
And so it just gets very personal, you know, what was it like for you growing up? How do you feel as a person who's also a politician? All that kind of stuff, which isn't very typical in the French political space. And so it really played a role in humanizing her in a way that has also helped to normalize what amounts to a lot of radical policies and some real Islamophobia.
So in your article, you walk us through how she's transformed, particularly in the last 6 months or so. Describe that transformation into the sort of authentic Marine Le Pen that we're seeing now.
So a couple of things happened. One is that in 2012, which is the last time she ran for president, she did really well with women, or at least the National Front did. That's the first thing. The second thing is that she figured out that she could broaden the appeal of the party by reaching out to and cultivating voters from gay communities, from minority communities, and of course, women. And that's how we've ended up with the Marine Le Pen that we have now. Soft, feminine, not feminist, feminine, and really trying to appeal and bolster those women's votes.
Who are the women who are supporting her if on so many levels she's very anti-feminist? What are the issues that are attracting female voters in France to her platform?
Well, like female voters anywhere, they don't all vote as a bloc, right? Women don't necessarily vote, quote unquote, as women. Women have as many different political interests as men. But one of the groups of women that Marine Le Pen has really appealed to are sort of lower wage workers who, women and men, really feel like they're getting screwed by the economic situation in France right now. Another big part of the appeal, though, is her anti-immigration stance. And the researchers who've really looked at this gender gap closure issue from an academic perspective say, hey, look, she is getting more women, but it's not like they're women who say, well, I guess she's a woman, so I'll vote for her, even though I don't like her anti-immigration stance or I don't like her Islamophobia. These are people who agree with her policies first and happen to be women second.
Are there any comparisons with Hillary Clinton in terms of a person who has struggled with what image to portray and how to get out of the shadow of some other person who is closely associated with them?
You know, loosely, there's an interesting commonality here, and it's important not to push this too far. But one parallel is that Marine Le Pen, when she ran in 2012, didn't court women, didn't want to talk about being a woman, wasn't interested in that. And that's kind of similar to what we might remember from Hillary Clinton's 2008 primary run. And then in the next election cycle, Hillary, like Marine Le Pen, realized, hey, this is a block of voters I can really appeal to. The big difference, of course, and this is important, is that Hillary Clinton had a pretty clear platform for women's rights, for advancements of women's rights in the United States and also abroad, including her time as Secretary of State. Marine Le Pen obviously doesn't go in that policy direction.
At this point, what are Marine Le Pen's chances in this in Sunday's initial round?
Oh, man. You know, everybody says it's anybody's game. And I spent the last week there at the beginning of the week. The common wisdom was she'll probably advance to the second round. That's what people have been saying for a while. But all the conventional wisdom, all the polls were suggesting she'll definitely lose there. By the end of the week, people weren't singing quite the same tune. There's a lot of other scandals that are cropping up among the leading candidates. The underdog has surged in the polls. The political space in France is so volatile right now that the feeling really is anything could happen.
Gina Moore is global women's rights correspondent for BuzzFeed. Thanks, Gina.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, London's great taxidermy heist. Yep, stick around. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. President Donald Trump can create a social media firestorm here in the U.S. with one ill-chosen comment. I know, hardly news. But in this case, it's the South Koreans who've gone ballistic over something Trump said. In a recent interview with the Wall Street Journal, Trump said, quote, Korea actually used to be part of China. An official from the foreign ministry in Seoul said yesterday the comment is historically untrue and not worthy of a response. Well, I wanted to know a little bit more about this, so I pulled in the world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolfe. Chris, was Korea ever a part of China?
Well, Carol, I'm not very good at doing a Trump impersonation, but I have to say this is not so easy. It really depends who you talk to.
Sounds like you're weaseling around. What's the real story?
All right, so let's take it one step at a time. The Koreans. The Koreans are an intensely proud nation and extremely jealous of their sovereignty, and they easily get offended at any suggestion that they were ever subject to China. So they stick to a very strict, one would say legalistic definition that Korean national territory, and this is incontrovertible, was never administered as part of China by Chinese officials. So in that sense, no, they were never fully part of China.
I get the sense the Chinese have a different view.
Well, sort of. For most of its history, at the same time as being its own sovereign state, it was also a tributary state of China with different levels of sovereignty at different times in history.
What is a tributary state?
It's kind of like a gang that runs a neighborhood. You have to pay tribute to them or you're going to suffer the consequences. So when the bad boys in the hood come round, in this case China, you have to hand over the goods, like a regular racketeering exercise. You pay tribute to be left in some degree of peace. And if you don't, you suffer the consequences. And that's invasion or worse.
So Korea is still Korea, its own thing. But the Chinese come in and say, hey, you got to give us some things.
Right. So there's clearly kind of a subordinate relationship.
So what do you think happened at that meeting between Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping then for Trump to get the impression that he then expressed?
There's no official Chinese transcript of what was said, but I think it would be reasonable to assume that Xi tried to convey some of that complexity about the relationship between Korea and China and China's influence on there. So there's some concern in Korea that Xi may have actually said this and that this is causing even more offense, that it might illustrate the President Xi Jinping's what they call hegemonic ambitions, that he may want to actually like reassert Chinese sovereignty over the greater East Asia area. So whether he actually said this or whether he was trying to convey some of that complexity and it didn't quite get through the Trump filter, okay, it's hard to say.
Chris, what's your conclusion about all this? How do you rate the Trump comment?
Well, obviously, this is extremely sensitive and I'm going to offend somebody. And in this case, I think it's going to be the Koreans, because I'd probably say on balance, Trump is more right than wrong. I mean, if you look at examples of other empires where they've had tributary states like this, if you think of the British Empire in India, there were states like Hyderabad and Kashmir, which covered a huge part of the country and very important population centers. And they ran their own affairs under their own rulers, but they were subordinate and tributary to the British. And it was the same in the Russian Empire. Various Muslim sultanates were subordinate and paid tribute to the Tsar of all the Russias as well. So I think if you had used this example anywhere else, you would say, yeah, they were kind of under the Chinese Empire, but obviously technically never fully administered and integrated as part of China proper.
The world's history guy, Chris Wolfe. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome, Carol.
London's seen its fair share of outrageous heists over the years. Banks, diamonds, gold bullion even. All child's play, though, compared to this story from the world's Leo Hornack.
Alexis Turner is a busy man. So busy that when he meets me, he barely has time to stop for a hello. Are you Alexis? Sorry. Nice to meet you. And I noticed that the reason you found it a bit difficult to shake my hand was you were carrying an elephant's foot under one arm. It's a stuffed elephant foot. A Victorian gentleman's idea of a trash can. The elephant itself probably last used that foot over a century ago. But it's unusual items like this that brought Alexis and his business into the crosshairs of London's criminal underworld.
It never occurred to me that anybody, in fact we used to sort of joke about it really, that nobody's ever going to come in and steal a giraffe because it's a pretty difficult thing to shift at the best of times. So why would anybody do that? I've been in the business now for 25 years. I've never had anything stolen.
Until last year, that is. Alexis's work is taxidermy for hire. Stuffed creatures, great and small. We're entering.
We're entering the ground floor.
Oh my God, look at this place. If you're looking to rent a full-size king penguin, an Indian fruit bat, or even just a stuffed cat for your fashion shoot or film set, Alexis is your man. His warehouse is something to behold.
And this is where the burglary took place.
Wow. Let's just move that antelope. Yeah. And just go past the lion with the bowler hat. Picture a sort of huge shipping container on Noah's Ark. A camel chills with a sloth. A macaw hangs with a moose.
And this is a giant squid.
That's huge.
Yeah, that's quite a popular one for hire.
If you've seen any exotic stuffed creatures in Harry Potter, Pirates of the Caribbean, or Downton Abbey, you've seen Alexa's empire at work. One day last year, he opened up the gates to find that some of the animals had been exiting two by two.
It was about 7:30 in the evening, and the gang had actually been on site for a couple of hours beforehand. We had all this on CCTV, so they came in very quickly, back to the van up against the big doors that you can see here.
Just over there behind us.
Yes, and they...
Just behind the ostrich, two of the ostriches and the crocodile.
That's right, and as soon as they got the locks off, they started loading the animals into the back of the van.
It was quite a haul.
Yes, I mean, they had a couple of giraffes. Both the lions that you can see here were taken. They took the chimpanzee in the top hat, which actually does quite well as a prop.
A rhino head also went missing. But as Alexis is keen to point out, any endangered items like that are only fiberglass replicas. So what was the criminal's game plan?
Well, exactly. I'd love to know, really, because demand for a giraffe is not an everyday request. And if you're trying to sell it down the pub, it's a difficult thing to take down the pub to sell, you know. Much better as a criminal sticking to Rolex watches, I think.
It's possible the gang had the same thought. Alexis alerted the taxidermy community across Britain, and a few weeks later, the police received an anonymous tip-off to visit a remote location. It was a scene worthy of Scorsese.
This anonymous caller called in and gave details of the van that had been abandoned in a field in Essex, just outside London, and the police arrived and opened up the van and found the whole lot untouched, still in the van. So it was a very big relief, really.
The gang's getaway driver was convicted this month for his part in the crime. He got away without jail time, and he refused to squeal on his accomplices. So the rest of the Dead Sloth gang are still out there. Alexis won't let me describe his new security measures, but I can tell you there are now eyes on you wherever you step in this warehouse.
Oh, and I see just in the toilet there's a full-size stuffed sheep holding the toilet door open.
Yes, it always catches people by surprise if they ask to use the toilet and they come around the corner and see the sheep.
For The World, Leo Hornack, Wimbledon, London.
Non-taxidermy-related headlines are up next. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. In California, an Iranian-American law student helps immigrants in detention.
Do you remember my 14-year-old client that was in immigration jail?
Yeah.
We got him out yesterday.
Oh, I'm so glad, Mama Jen. That's a good job.
Thank you, Mommy.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Protests in Venezuela took a violent turn yesterday. At least three people were killed when anti-government protesters clashed with police. Today, the protesters, who want to oust leftist President Nicolas Maduro, are back on the streets. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Washington's keeping a close eye on what's happening in Venezuela.
We are concerned that the government of Maduro is violating its own constitution and is not allowing the opposition to have their voices heard, nor allowing them to organize in a way that expresses the views of the Venezuelan people. Yes, we are concerned about that situation.
Let's go now to Yolanda Valere. She's one of our colleagues at the BBC's Spanish language service, BBC Mundo. Yolanda, you've been covering the events in Venezuela closely. Yolanda, these protests have been huge. Why are these protests taking place now?
I suppose the trigger for this particular wave of protest is the Supreme Court's ruling a couple of weeks ago, which deemed every decision by the parliament not to be valid. That particular decision was later overturned. However, it caused a lot of anger because it was a bit like the last straw. It was very hard for the government to keep saying that they are a democratic regime if you had that such a situation in which the Supreme Court goes and says the parliament is no longer valid. So although the decision was overturned, people were saying, well, the damage is done and you cannot take that away. If you couple that with the economic situation, which is affecting people on an everyday basis, and I don't mean, you know, the forecast by the IMF saying that inflation this year is going to be 700%. I mean people who are on on a daily basis find hard to grab hold of food, of basic food, of medicines, of basic needs. And it's a continued grievance, and it's now come to the point where people are thinking they cannot take it anymore.
What do people say who actually support the government?
Well, they will acknowledge that the situation is not ideal, but they will say this you can explain using arguments that are not under the control of the government. They will say, as President Maduro said very recently, that the United States is behind another attempted coup against him. And they say it's the forces of the, you know, old businessman class, which is conspiring against whatever plans the government has. So they'll justify this and they say, you know, whichever we have now is better to what we had in the past, because we are talking about people who historically have felt left out by politicians in Venezuela.
Yolanda, how is your own family getting by in Venezuela?
Well, I only have like extended family back in Venezuela, and they are going through exactly the same situation the rest of Venezuelans are, whether they are in the supporters of the government or supporters of the opposition. I do have, for instance, a cousin. She used to have a bakery, a sort of a bakery business, and she just had to give it all up, and she had to sell all her equipment because simply she couldn't grab hold of sugar and she couldn't grab hold of flour to keep baking cakes, you know, for sale. And I have another cousin who is a taxi driver in the inner country, and you know, she's been a victim of crime, she's been robbed, and all this stuff is stuff that happens to Venezuelans on a daily basis. Where I do have an aunt who is from the Chavismo, and you should see her just defending this revolution as if there's nothing else in life, nothing else for it.
Yolanda, it's now 4 years since Hugo Chavez died, and the country is certainly as divided as ever. As a Venezuelan, how do you feel about the country's future?
It'll be fair to say that I am a little bit pessimistic. Situation, it's obvious that it's not good. It's not good for daily Venezuelans, for common Venezuelans, and it's not good for the country as a whole. But whatever happens, whatever changes can be brought about, there is no instant answer. There is no short-term answer. Whether the government remains or there is a change, and let's assume the government remains and they start making the right decisions, even in that particular scenario, for the country to recover, it's going to take years. The damage that's been inflicted in a country that it's been divided for two decades, that you have families who cannot talk to each other because they are on different sides of the spectrum. The state of productive activity in Venezuela is all in such a bad situation that I don't see it mending in the short term or even in the medium term. So as a Venezuelan, I find it really, really hard. It's hard to witness, and it's hard just to try and analyze it with you at this moment.
Yolanda Valeri is Venezuelan. She's with BBC's Spanish language service, BBC Mundo. Thanks, Yolanda.
Thank you very much.
Here's my question. How can Venezuela, rich with oil, be in such dire economic straits right now? Alejandro Velasco has been trying to answer that. He teaches modern Latin American history at NYU. Velasco says it's because former President Hugo Chavez only invested in the short term.
Chavez's vision of socialism was to hand out cash directly. So rather than, for instance, spending in significant infrastructure projects that would have a long-term benefit for the nation, people receive just cash distribution.
So you have a situation where, okay, when times are good, oil money comes in. Chavez chooses to help alleviate the poor and provide benefits in order to, in part, to achieve electoral victory next time around. So there's a lack of domestic investment. And so is the translation that in these hard times, then, that's why there's no domestic products available? They're relying on imports?
It's partly it. But again, in terms of the question of why this bust is as significant as it has been, it's because, again, most of those benefits had to be spent with a short-term strategy rather than a long-term one. And as a result, now that there is no money to be had and there is no infrastructure long-term spending under the Chavez years, that means that we're left with a situation where we have neither the benefits of, you know, significant domestic production spending or the benefits of, you know, to buy imports. So that's what makes this particular crisis so much worse.
Now, the term currency controls comes up when I read about Venezuela's economy, and I don't really understand what that means. What are currency controls and what's been their impact on the economy?
In 2002 and 2003, in the winter, there was an oil industry strike that was meant to get rid of the Chavez government. What that meant, of course, was that Venezuela did not have the benefit of any oil income for about a month and a half. The response of the Chavez government was to restrict the amount of dollars that circulated in the economy such that there wouldn't be a capital flight. The government does that by controlling the inflow and the outflow of dollars that are available in the open market. That is what a currency control exchange is. Now, this works in a short-term context when there's an emergency situation such as it was in 2003. The problem is that that currency exchange control has been maintained for the last 13 years. And that has created a tremendous amount of corruption.
Is it that Venezuelan officials are pocketing money and then exchanging it on the black market themselves? So they're...
That's exactly right.
So then you get a whole bunch of bolivars and you go out and buy stuff with bolivars. Is that the idea?
Exactly. Precisely. But of course, what that does is it contributes to inflation. And so people on the street that don't have access to dollars, they are now caught having to buy scarce products at that black market rate. If you have access to dollars, however, you're living like a king because there's this huge differential between the official and the black market rate, right? So you have this tremendous paradox in Venezuela right now. And when I tell this to people, they don't believe it, but it's true. You have very fancy restaurants full. You have tremendously luxurious malls also full, people buying what they can, especially if they have bolivares, because it makes no rational sense to keep them. So you need to spend. So there is a strange kind of spending spree happening at the same time as there's a shortage of products.
Right now, given Venezuela's economy, given the situation there, which is deteriorating by the day, what changes could improve the situation?
Well, the immediate thing that needs to happen is the elimination of the currency exchange controls. That would release a tremendous amount of cash for the government to be able to spend in other ways rather than to subsidize this corruption that is currently the case. The other part then is to solicit international investment for certain.
Why would anyone be interested in foreign investment in Venezuela at this point? I mean, we have multinationals who are pulling out.
Well, I think that all that is premised upon a government changing.
Alejandro Velasco is a Latin American history professor at NYU. He's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Roughly 15 million people around the world work informally in trash dumps. They scavenge stuff that can be reused, recycled, even eaten. Yep, it's about the worst job you can imagine. But there is an alternative, and it's coming to life in Morocco. That's where one group of former trash pickers are now employees at a new recycling center. Rebecca Rossman has the story.
It's a lovely and sunny day in a creche, just outside Morocco's capital, Rabat. But Yassine Mazout doesn't much like standing in the sun. That's because for 10 years when he was a kid, he worked at night, outside right here. We're on a hill that used to be home to Rabat's biggest landfill. Yassine speaks to me in French, a second language for many Moroccans.
I didn't get to play with other kids. I spent every second of free time working here to make money for my family.
Several times a week, Yassine would come here straight from school and work through the night as a dump picker, gleaning anything he could sell from the trash. He was one of several hundred trash pickers. It was tough work, but it wasn't just the filth and hazards of the landfill itself. Yassine's a naturally subdued guy, but at the landfill, he says he had to be aggressive. But he says being here doesn't bring back bad memories.
It's just a piece of my history. We all have histories, bad or good, but man is able to change.
Yassine speaks from experience. He's seen his fellow trash pickers turn from enemies into family. It happened here, at a new recycling center a few miles away. When the government shut down the old landfill in 2010, the trash pickers were offered jobs at the new facility. It's called Azza, and instead of digging through a mountain of trash outdoors, the workers here sort recyclable items off a conveyor belt in a new building. Najat Rabat used to work next to Yassine at the landfill. Now she works with him here.
Before, I could work up to 13 hours a day in horrible conditions. Now it's only 6 hours and in much better conditions.
The pay is also better. workers have insurance benefits, even free transportation to work. And instead of ruthless competition, the culture is based on cooperation. But getting here wasn't easy. Many Gidi is a consultant who advised the workers on the transition.
They worked at a landfill without any rules. So the state said to them, if you want to keep working, you need to make a cooperative and you need to have rules.
Gidi says it was difficult for the workers to abandon their old lifestyle. But it slowly came together. The workers named their new cooperative Atawa Fuk, which loosely translates to trust. They agreed that everyone would make the same salary. They chose council members and a president. And every year since the cooperative was founded, Yasin has been elected president. He's a superstar, says this co-worker. As president, it's his job not just to organize his colleagues. He also has to stand up for their interests with management. But even managers admire him.
Yasin was not what you would call in French a béni oui oui.
Gérard Prenon is a former manager at the facility.
When you suggested something, he wouldn't just say yes. He defended the interests of the cooperative. But we always found a compromise, and it allowed us to innovate this kind of relationship.
Today, most cooperative members say they couldn't imagine going back to the way things were at the landfill. And the change is also good for the environment. The cooperative recycled more than 12,000 tons of trash last year and hopes to double that this year. That's only a small slice of Morocco's waste, but it could be the start of something bigger.
The success story of the Tawafo cooperative, it can definitely be replicated.
Maria Saraf is an environmental economist at the World Bank, which helped fund the project.
El Tawafo was the first one, but if we come back in a few years, there should be many more of them.
In fact, the World Bank is already helping launch 18 similar projects in Morocco. They're expected to create about 1,000 formal jobs for waste pickers. And Saraf believes the model could spread elsewhere to help transform the lives of some of the millions of dump pickers around the world. For his part, Yassine Mazout is working to help create more recycling cooperatives in Morocco. But things move slowly here. And for now, his cooperative remains the only one. It's not perfect, he says. But it's a huge step forward.
There's lots of things we're missing, but we have a real source of work. The spirit of the cooperative is work.
For the World, Rebecca Rossman, Rabat.
Before the break, I want to tell you about a story we'll bring you tomorrow. It's about an Iranian scientist, an astronomer, who discovered her passion early. When she was 12, Sona Husseini learned about the planets, the galaxies, the universe, by hanging out at the local university.
It was huge, because all my friends were PhD students and cosmologists. And I would jump in and ask any question that I want.
She studied hard, earned degrees, moved to the U.S., and while working on a lonely mountaintop telescope, she slipped into depression.
That was exactly where I wanted. My dream was to be in an observatory. That was my dream growing up, and it was so sad. I drowned myself. Putting all these expectations on myself, it almost suffocated me.
How she got through depression and found a work-life balance that includes both the stars and a great life on Earth. The story of astronomer Sona Husseini, right here, tomorrow. President Trump's attempts at travel bans have met with intense legal opposition. In fact, back in January, we brought you stories about lawyers and law students who rushed to airports to help those affected by Trump's executive order. That legal work continues. Zadie Stavely has the story of some law students in California who are motivated to help because of their own immigrant experiences.
Set them free! Set them free!
Outside a detention center in Northern California, a group is protesting that dozens of unaccompanied child migrants are being held inside. They're also celebrating a victory. A 14-year-old boy from Honduras has been released to a foster home after more than a year in detention. Sarah Asani Nia, a law student at the University of California, Davis, saw him just after he was released.
It was really remarkable. He was wearing the clothes that he wore when he was brought into detention a year ago. And that was literally the only thing that he owned, is like that t-shirt, those shorts, and those sandals.
Asani Nia asked that we only use the boy's initials, GE, because he's a minor in foster care. GE fled severe abuse in his home in Honduras. He fled alone, crossed the Texas border, and turned himself in to authorities. He has no family in the U.S. Isani Nia met the boy in detention through the Immigration Law Clinic at UC Davis. It lets students take on cases with guidance.
Every time we visited him, we would bring a deck of cards with us and play cards or dominoes. And we felt that that would kind of loosen him up, put a smile on his face, and make it maybe slightly easier to ask some of the difficult questions.
Many of the students at this clinic at UC Davis come from immigrant families themselves.
I was born in Los Angeles, and my parents are refugees from Iran. The foundation is the same. You're coming to this country with virtually nothing.
But Isani Nia knows her family's story is different than GE's.
My family wasn't in detention. I mean, it's drastically different. Immigration detention is jail. It's jail conditions, and it takes a huge psychological toll.
Actually, we also were lucky enough that he wrote back.
¿Cómo ha estado? Espero que bien.
Outside the detention center, an immigration rights advocate reads a letter from the boy, G.E., to the supporters who pressured for his release and gave him donated clothes.
Me gustó la gorra de Red Sox. I really like the Red Sox hat. I hope that I can meet you someday. Con mucho cariño, GE. With lots of love, GE.
Later, Isani Nia takes a moment in her car to call her mom.
Hello.
Salam, Mamon Jun.
Salam, Ashika.
Khaste nabashi, Mamon.
She greets her mom in Farsi, then switches to English.
Do you remember my 14-year-old client that was in immigration jail?
Yeah.
We got him out yesterday.
Oh, I'm so glad, Mamajan. That's a good job.
Thank you, Mommy.
At the University Law Clinic, Professor Holly Cooper supervises the students. Her grandfather fled Russia as a child. She says her family history pulls her to this work. It's something she notices with the students, too.
A lot of what you see with all the students, it's almost like this sort of like invisible thread, you know, of your past, sort of pulling you to do certain areas of work.
Cooper introduces me to other students whose families are from India, Mexico, and China. Their stories make them strong advocates, Cooper says. After Donald Trump's inauguration, the clinic is receiving more calls now from students wanting to help out. For Sarah Isani Nia and many of her fellow law students, Trump's executive orders on immigration feel personal.
It's scary to feel attacked in this way. It's very insulting, and professionally it's scary to see our clients going through so much distress.
When Trump's executive order tried blocking certain people from entering the U.S., Isani Nia drove to San Francisco to help an elderly Iranian couple detained at the airport. For the first time, she spoke Farsi for her legal work. It felt good, she says, and reminded her of something her parents taught her, to value her citizenship by voting, raising her voice, and standing up for the rights of others. For The World, Zadie Stavely, Davis, California.
The last time we had Irish singer Imelda May on the show, her music sounded like this. Johnny got a boom boom, Johnny got a bam. You got it. And she had a rockabilly look to match, a sort of 1950s bouffant, a big hair curl in the front, ponytail in the back. Now Imelda May has shed that look and that sound, and she says the move was intentional.
Yes. 100%. I felt like I'd dress up as Imelda May going on stage. Not that I was being fake. As you get older, you change. And, you know, and as a woman, you change after having a child and, you know, being married forever and then getting divorced. I mean, things change. And I just felt that wasn't me anymore. And I had been for a while. And it got to a point where I didn't quite know what to do because that was had become my whole career in a while. And I just didn't feel that it was right for me anymore. I should spare your love just a thing or two, but you don't disguise it when I'm just white noise and it's done before it begins. Cause your temper's getting thin.
May's new sound is showcased in her new album. It's called Life, Love, Flesh, Blood. It was produced by T-Bone Burnett. YouTube frontman Bono also helped out, especially on this song. It's about a woman who feels unappreciated by her partner and decides to stand up for herself. Female empowerment, in other words. May says Bono heard the track and gave her this piece of advice.
He said, you can't call it Who Takes Care of Me. That's too victimized. You got to call it Should Have Been You, because that's what I'm singing. And I said, you're absolutely right.
May went further with that female empowerment message in the music video.
In this video, I have a lot of women joining me on this video, and older women and younger women, and some good solidarity. And I want to acknowledge the suffragettes in there, get women in white in there, and all races, all creeds. You know, this is a couple of weeks ago, Russia just decriminalized domestic abuse, you know, and it's a weird time for women, especially, and here in America too, and in Brexit. It feels kind of strange. So I wanted to have quite a big nod to that in this next video for women, not just on a personal level, but also in a world level. Don't forget about us. We're like 50% of the world. There's just one thing that I want to know. Just one little thing before I go. Before I go. It's who takes care of me.
Irish singer-songwriter Imelda May takes us out today. You can see the video to that song, Should Have Been You, at PRI.org. And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
Public Radio International.